So, Mike, I think we're live. I'm not 100% sure. So, just give you a bit of a housekeeping microphone. Just keep it this distance away. Away from the
I know
sound.
that well.
So, Mike, thanks a million for coming on. It's been a while in the making.
Definitely, we've discussed it for a while, yeah.
We've put it off a few times because there are certain things coming up and they wanted to include that and talk about it, which I think is great. So, yeah, let's get straight into it. Like, I've known you probably 6 or 7 years
That's
now.
right,
We're
that's right.
mates.
Yeah.
Good group of Irish people.
Definitely taking
Yeah,
over.
we're not here to take part. We're here to take
That's
over.
right.
Yeah, so I want to go back to Ireland basically, because that's,
Yeah.
you know, because I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I know about you, and there's a lot of stuff that I don't know, and I'm excited to find out the stuff I don't know.
Yep, of
You know,
course.
so you know, this way you're on the podcast, like you're an inspiration to a lot of people. I know you don't really see that, but
Yeah,
I can tell you
jury's
are.
out on that.
So, mate, you grew up not far from where I'm from there, Kenny.
That's right,
I
that's right.
think we're going to struggle, by the way, with the captions on here.
I'd put him a post today. Can people have their translators at the ready?
So, back to Letterkenny. So, you grew up in Letterkenny. I
Yep.
remember going to Letterkenny nightclub. I remember as soon as, you know, it was 1 or 2 a.m., it's over, and next thing they play the national anthem.
That's right. They still do that at home.
Did
It's
they?
mental. It's just like it's everybody stands the attention, and they have the slow sets as well. You know,
That's quite brilliant.
but I every nightclub, the end of the night, stand the attention.
I
you
know,
dare not
flinch.
talk or flinch during the national anthem, or you get lynched by the mob. Literally,
No, it's surreal.
it's crazy. It's I have to pinch myself when I go home, and they still do that. But you know what? It's part of Irish
That's
culture,
it, it's
and
part of
it's
history.
maybe it's some of the reason why Irish people are so patriotic and so loyal, which is a flag we carry around the world with pride, you know.
So you grew up in Letterkenny. What was your sort of background before you came to Australia? This is the part that I don't
Yeah,
know.
absolutely. Went to secondary school at St. Union's Secondary School, all boys Catholic school. I went to after school, I wanted to study physiotherapy. I actually, when I left high school or secondary school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was a bit lost, and but I was doing a lot of sport, and I got injured, and I had to go and see a physiotherapist. And I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. But at the time, I had no science subject in my what's the leaving cert was. I think it was A levels for you guys, was it, or you know whatever the exams when you finish high
I
school.
think two subjects.
So I had to go to my local. IT, it's called like the regional college, and do. I got enough points in my leaving certificate to get into physiotherapy, but I didn't have a science subject in my last subjects, so I had to go and do a basic 1 year degree in science. So I entered this degree in science in Letterkenny IT, and I just for some reason, you know, part of the course was. There was a chemistry module, and I did very well on that. So then at the end of the year, a few of my chemistry professors came and said to me, like, Mike, you know, how passionate are you about physio? Because you've got a bit of a knack for this chemistry thing. We think you should go on and do it. So I did a second year at that, which was applied chemistry with IT. And then that got me into a chemistry degree in Glasgow. So after 2 years, I got in and I went into the second year of the degree in Glasgow in chemistry. And I was in my final year at chemistry doing this degree in applied chemistry in Glasgow, and I realized I hated chemistry.
I would never have picked it, to be fair.
I
I'd
know, I
never have
know.
picked you doing chemistry. I remember doing chemistry at school. It was
Yeah,
proper Chinese, and it was so
totally. So
hard.
I kind of was like, oh my God, what have I done here? And I was like, I've started, so I'll finish. So I said, at least I'll finish the degree, and then I'll see what my options are after that. So after I did that, I got offered a place doing a postgraduate in Paisley Uni, and that was applied chemistry with IT and instrumentation, because I thought if I did that, that would let me make the jump into IT. And at the time, it was like 2001, and the internet was going crazy with the tech boom, and I was hearing all these people walking out of college and making crazy money just straight off the bat, and I was like, all right, that sounds good to me, you know, 21-year-old kid, like just hungry,
Cheap.
hungry to make some cash. And then I went in to study my postgrad, and I finished that. So I went from there, and I started working for the Clydesdale Bank in Glasgow, and I was doing software engineering, but because I was entry level, it was more like network support.
Yeah.
And I did that for about a year, year and a bit, and then I was just kind of like just questioning corporate lifestyle. And at the time, the whole time I'd been living in Glasgow, I had a couple of great mates that I was living with, and we'd always been into music, and you know, we'd started DJing, and we literally had like, I think there was 8 Technics turntables in a house with 3 of us. You know, there was like, you couldn't go into a room without there being decks and records in there. And we'd run a few parties and a few events just for fun, you know, like just great crowd of our mates. And so when I came over to Australia, I was like, obviously like still very passionate about dance music, but I knew I wanted to take a break from doing anything that was like corporate or career related. So I got a job on a building site. I was doing that for like 5 months. Over the time I was there, I was the first weekend I was in Australia, a couple of my good mates, Swedish John and George, said to me, "You got to go and check out this place called Revolver," and stepped in there. And that was a moment in time that probably changed my life. But
what brought you to Australia? What was the intention?
It was just, you know what? I'd been in Glasgow for about 6-7 years at that stage, and I just fancied getting out and doing something. Like, I'd finished my degree, which was 3.5 years, and then I'd taken a year out and gone to America, or 10 months out and gone to America during that time period. And then I came back, and then I did my postgrad, and that was another year, and then I had 3-4 months off work, and then I'd worked for a year and a bit. So I just wanted to get out and travel a bit. And
that was,
you know,
the time that a lot of people were
totally
over here.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Australia, like, everybody's coming back with these amazing stories, but when I got on the flight, I was like, I said to everybody, I'll see you in a year. I had no intentions of staying here. And I came to Melbourne, and just literally on the first weekend I got here, I just met this amazing group of people. And there's 2 or 3 of the guys I met in that first weekend, John and George, and that it was like 16 years ago, became my best friends, and they're my best friends to this day, you know. So yeah, I mean, John's working in the office with us now. You see him every day. George just had a kid, you know. But I just found this amazing group of people. And then, you know, we're young and we're going to Revolver at the weekends and seeing Boogs just like light up Revolver every Sunday morning. That like absolutely changed my life, you know. So just that was what brought me over here. And when I came over, I said I was going to do 5 months in Melbourne, 5 months in Sydney, and spend 2 months traveling around Australia. I did 6 months in Melbourne. I got myself to Sydney. I did 3 months in Sydney, and I was living in Bondi. I really enjoyed it, but it was a really different experience to Melbourne. You know, Melbourne, I was like going out a lot, and whereas when I went up to Bondi, it was like surfing and living in Bondi Beach. But for some reason, something just said to me, I need to get back to Melbourne. Something was drawing me back, and I literally like got up one night and kind of packed my bags and came back to Melbourne. I thought, I'll spend the rest of my year working in Melbourne. And then I just stayed, you know.
That's what they say. We're like, so you flew into Melbourne from Ireland.
That's right.
Like, so that's what they say. Wherever you land, you fall in love with.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Sydney, when you come to Sydney, and I think that was my choice. And then that's.
I think this is the greatest city in the world, man. There's nothing like it. I just love this place, you know.
So mate, then tell me, thickest things. Where did it come from originally? It must have been after that.
I got the sec. I came back, I really didn't want to leave. And right before, when I came back to Melbourne, I met a couple of amazing people. There was a record shop that I used to buy a lot of records in called Central Station. And I was going in there all the time. And long story short, I ended up getting a job in there. And the owner at the time decided, basically said, like, you know, I was doing quite well. And he said they would sponsor me. But at the time, we had to wait. I had to have done another year in Australia. They had set up a sub company, but that company wasn't trading long enough to sponsor me. So they said, we can sponsor you in a year from now. So I went on a student visa for a year, did a diploma in audio engineering at SA. No. I did a diploma in audio engineering and that allowed me to work as well part-time while I was here. And then I got sponsored, and then I spent 3 or 4 years working in Central Station Records. And then me and 2 of the other guys, or 3 of the other guys, sorry, Jeanette and Jimmy and Frosty, we ended up taking over the business from the owner. And we had that for like 5 years. And that was like that was like an amazing experience in my life. It was like I can't thank those guys enough. It was a huge learning curve, and getting to see how a business ran properly, and the musical education I got from those guys, because they were like pillars in the music community. I was DJing, and really cemented my place, I guess, in the music community in Melbourne at that time. So yeah, I was working there for like maybe we had the shop for like 4 or 5 years, and then unfortunately, like the record store, like we were probably like the prominent record store at the time. We changed the name from Central Station to become Here Now, which was Central Station was a brand that was owned by someone else, and then we called it Here Now, which was our own brand. So then me and Frosty started running some parties under the brand Here Now. But what happened was, like within a very, very short space of time, when iTunes and Beatport kicked in, the record sales just fell through the floor. And unfortunately, like we just became a victim of the environment. It wasn't anything we were doing wrong. And the writing was on the wall for the record store. So
I just got a picture of the guy in the traffic.
It was pretty similar.
You behind the decks.
But I mean, we were like, I don't think there was an international DJ that came through Melbourne for a tour between 2004 and 2008 that wasn't in our record shop all the time. And it was a real hub of
building the network.
And then one of the things we looked at was, when the record sales, they fell so dramatically. I remember at one stage talking to the boys about it and Jeanette about it. And they had said that in the space of 8 months, our weekly consignment of records went from 3,000 to 300. Like, and that was just like when the digital thing really kicked in, and we were just like, whoa, this is. So then, me and Frosty started running a few events, and then we started doing a few tours as well. Frosty was very tight with, if you remember the Ed Banger guys, like Busy P and those guys, and he brought out a few of them. We put a few tours together. I had quite a few contacts from home. Phil Kieran, Optimo, knew those guys from home. So we started the touring thing. And then it kind of got to the stage where we were just like, this is, it's inevitable what's going on with the shop here. So, I just said to the guys, after a while, got my permanent residency. And I just said, guys, I just don't feel the business is sustainable the way it is. And we all kind of parted ways. And, Frosty and Jimmy, so Frosty's still now very, very prominent. He's the head of Animal Dancing. Right. And he's gone and like we're kind of both running events now and doing tours, but he's in a different market to what I'm in. There's a little bit of crossover because we still do some stuff together, but I'm incredibly indebted to those guys for the education I got and for the for the experience.
They got under their wing.
Oh man, they absolutely. I was like an Irish boy green off the boat, and they I learned a lot,
Yeah. I'm just reading comments here. Your mic closer. Put your big face closer to the mic. So then I suppose was that the sort of entryway into setting up the
So like I think it was like 2008 that I left the record store, and then 2009 I kind of I went out on my own and just started set up Thick as Thieves, and I'd started doing a few tours. And
so you set up Thick as Thieves on your own?
It was me and Boogs. So right, like, okay. I had an idea. Like, I was involved in these events, and we were buying acts off other people for the events. And I was looking at the way some of the touring companies were doing things, and you'd go and pick up these artists, and you'd say to them like, what have you been doing in Australia? And they were like, we're just in a hotel room. And I said, is nobody taking you out, or nobody? Nobody looking after you. And they were like, and I think there was a lot of the big companies at the time had a general consensus of like, they're getting paid so they can look after themselves. And I just thought like, you're coming all the way from Europe, and this country has so much to offer, So I saw a little bit of a niche where I was like, people want to come here. People want to have a good time as well. So
yeah,
started putting a few tours together, but also focused on the experience of Australia and Melbourne in particular. So all the artists came out here, we started taking them, for example, out to Healesville Sanctuary, where you see, and like, it's weird, Pete, because like some of these artists that are flying halfway across the world, for them to show their kid a picture of them feeding a kangaroo is just like, that's, you know, it makes them so happy. So then, you know, like, you know, there was a lot of stuff we started doing to create a really good artist experience. And, you know, I guess, you know, word of mouth started traveling that, like, you know, when I started bringing these guys out, that, you know, the first, I guess, batch of artists that I brought out, they all went back and said to their friends, look, you know, Australia was amazing. We had this incredible time. You know, here's Mike's contact. And a few people started hitting me up. And yeah, the first year, I think I did 9 tours, you know, and then like last year we did like close to 90, you know. So like, wow. it's grown exponentially every year. And it's like, yeah, it's just been that's the touring side of things. And then I guess, you know, I was running events with Frosty again. And then, we, you know, a lot of the acts I was bringing out started, you know, I was involved in this brand called Summer Series with Kev and Daniel, Daniel from Novel and Kev from Stable. And we had that for 10 years. So we would tour some of the acts and we would do the shows ourselves. And, you know, it was a slow burner, but it just like, it really took off. I remember one year in particular, we had like, I think it was like 2013 or 2014, but we had like MK, Finnebason, Patrick Topping and a few others. And it was just at the year when they all just like exploded. And, you know, Revolver went from, you know, it went from like 150, 200 people on a Sunday night to just like line the whole way down the whole way down Chapel Street. So yeah, we just, you know, we're probably very lucky with that as well. But people just started coming to the events and having a good time. And we always, the same way with the artist experience, I would always make an effort to talk to the punters and find out get feedback. Like, you know, it's like, I mean, I used to go to a lot of events myself, and it's like, you know, just saying to people, like, are you having a good night? What could we do better? And continually trying to improve, you know, is like,
because you're lost.
That's it, you know, and and I think as well, people, you know, punters like the connection with the people organizing the party, you know, because they see that you're just like a normal punter like them who just wants to come and have a good night, you know. So like for somebody to say to somebody who's organizing an event, oh, this is what I think you should do, and them to take it on board and maybe action it, like, and you know, it means a lot to people, you know. So it's always been a big theory of mine that like the punter experience and the artist experience from the touring and the events point of view is just absolutely fulcrum to the Thickest Thieves ethos and on running things, you know. So
the buck stops with them.
Absolutely.
You don't have the artists, you don't have the gigs.
And it's weird because there's a fair few artists that, like, you know, we've toured and then we've done shows with, and we've helped them build a connection with the punters in Melbourne. So there's particular artists that, like, they've got this massive following in Melbourne that they probably don't have anywhere else. But it's like, it's just a combination of us working with them working with the punters, and the punters working with us, you know. And it just makes them feel, everybody feel included. And, you know, that's what we want. You know, that's the whole idea of, raising the vibration.
Yeah, that's it. So you've toured, you know, some of my favorite DJs, Kulch, Patrick Topping.
Yeah.
It's like, these guys rave. They love Melbourne. You can see on their social media. Like, they just say it's just the best parties.
And the parties are great, Pete, as well. And again, it comes back to, from a touring perspective, like I've always said, touring is like, you know, there's a financial element to it. But, you know, if you break it down, and people are traveling the whole way across the world for once a year for maybe 2 weekends or even 1 weekend. There's two things that they need. They need good gigs and they need to have a good time.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just like, it's not rocket science, you know, like just make sure they're looked after. Make sure, you know, they're having a good experience in Australia, and make sure the people they meet are nice. And it's funny because, like, you know, there's quite a few of the artists I talk to, and they talk to other artists, and the other artists will say, oh, Australia's shit. It's like, you know, like we didn't. And I'm like, how is that possible? Australia is like amazing. You know, how is Melbourne, you know, it's like, best city in the world. How can you not have a good time here? It just baffles me, you know.
So it fell down for them.
I mean, I think it's just like, you know, look, you know, a lot of agents might only, some agents are ruled by the dollar, and it's like somebody flies halfway across the world here and they get paid well, but if they're playing in fucking some bottle service club where people don't give a shit about who they are or what they're playing, it's like, you know, like, what is the point? And it doesn't do their profile any good in the long run, you know. So I've always had a long-term strategy, and with regard to like building artist profiles, you know, I think I've got a good enough relationship with a lot of agents now where I'll say to them, you know, look, you can get more money playing here, but this is, you know, Revolver, for example, that's where you need to play, you know, to, you know, have a really good gig and get people talking, you know, like, and luckily, you know, people have I guess backed me and, you know, supported, let my vision of how to develop their profile work. And
yeah
it seems to work.
Yeah,
you know,
they trust you.
Yeah,
because like, they're seeing results.
Like, yeah,
the brand's growing.
Yeah, well, as long as you know, like, the gigs are getting better every year, you know, the fees are going up every year, the artists, you know, having a better time than the year before. And yeah, I mean, it's just a continual development process, but it's something that, like, if you plan it out right from the start, you can get it right, you know.
Brilliant. So like, it's 10-year anniversary for Thick as Thieves.
That's right. June. still kind of pinch myself, you know. It was like,
but before we go on to that, there, we'll, I just want to go back, because we want to talk about the Fred Hollows stuff, because that's something that's been been happening for the last few years, and like, the charity gigs and stuff. So that's helped you get to this 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
So tell me, I'm interested to know how you first came in contact with Fred Hollows and what the story is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the story about why Fred Hollows is simple. Like, when I was at
maybe just give a bit of an overview of what Fred Hollows, what they do.
Right. So Fred Hollows is a charity that's an Australian-based charity. So Fred Hollows was a absolute visionary doctor who basically devoted his whole life. He passed away in, I think it was, I can't remember, it was late 90s, but he passed away, and he spent his life doing two things, which was, one, trying to end blindness, which was resulted by cataract disease, because that is deemed as unnecessary blindness.
Yeah.
Now, four out of five people who are blind at the moment in the world don't have to be blind, and a simple operation that costs $25 can restore their eyesight. Fred Hollows, like, basically went to a lot of third world countries and just started doing these operations. And like, he was like, I read his autobiography, and it was, I mean, this guy was just one of the most incredible human beings on this planet. He went into these countries, and he had, you know, he had literally like no equipment, no, you know, facing political challenges as well, trying to face, you know, going into some of these countries where they think the white man's like the devil and your enemy, and he's just trying to like fix their eyesight. But like, he's literally, I think Fred Hollows has, the organization has restored the eyesight of 3.6 million people. You know, they're a charity that is like worldwide renowned for, they're audited every year, and the charity runs on 6% of the money that they take in. There's 19% that's spent on fundraising activities, but you know, like, on the, you know, on the biggest scheme of things, it makes it to it makes it to where it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to be out in Cambodia with them a couple of years ago, which I'll touch on later. But they're just an incredible organization. So they focus on restoring eyesight, and they focus on Indigenous health among in Australia. So yeah, Fred was just like, he just rounded up people and got like nurses and doctors and politicians and everyone to just just like cure these problems that you would not even think exist. Because when you live in, I guess, what you call white Australia, like, you have a cataract, you just go into the doctor and you get it fixed straight away. But people who haven't got access to health facilities, and especially in some of the third world countries, Nepal and Cambodia and Eritrea and places like that, this cataract just gets worse and worse, to the point where these people become blind. And it's like, you know, it's a simple operation to cure it, you know. So my story of how I got involved was, when I was at Letterkenny IT, there was a big kind of hallway, and in the middle of this hallway there was like a set of, so you imagine this hallway was like this, there was a set of stairs, and just from the middle went up, and it went over, and then it went up again. And there was an albino guy that was at the college, and you used to see him about, you know, obviously white hair, quite distinctive looking, and you know, albinos have traditionally got like short sight or bad eyesight. And I watched this guy one day and I saw it coming. I was like at the other end and I saw him like walking and I could see he couldn't see the steps. And he walked head first into these steps and he smashed his head. And these other guys beside him started laughing at them. And I was just like a red rag to a bull. I went down and tore strips out of them. And then I went over to the guy, "You all right?" And I'll never forget, Pete, the moment. The guy he said he was all right, but he kind of gave me a, like, this is what it's like every day. And I went home that night. I got so upset by it, you know, right. I really it really got me, you know.
Yeah.
But, I guess after that,
so that was your first, that was back in Ireland.
Yeah, that was back in Ireland. Yeah. Yeah. So right. I decided that like, no matter what I did, it was like, I was gonna definitely, do something for people to in regard to eyesight and blindness.
Right.
So when I set up Thick as Thieves, me and Boogs, pretty much from day one, we started running a few events. Boogs has been with me from the start. The deal was always like, I set it up and he was always like the musical leader, you know. And so me and Boog started running a few events and we raised some money. And, you know, at the time we went and gave that money to the Guide Dogs. And the Guide Dogs Association, it's a great organization, but what we found out was it cost 40 grand to train a guide dog, which is, you know, it's a lot of money. And then one day I was like, one dog.
Right.
And because you've got to have them with a person for a year, and it's like they're, you know, and a lot of the dogs don't make the cut, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So I think I was driving down Punt Road one day and I saw this massive sign for the Fred Olives Foundation. It said $25 can restore the gift of sight, and I was like, the fuck is this, man? How have I missed this? And I went on the website and I dug it up and I thought $25 can restore sight, and I was just like, I've got to do something about this. So literally the next day I walked into their office and I said, I want to raise some money for you. And they were like, what do you do? And I was like, I run rave parties. And they were just like, they were like, excuse me. They were like, how's this going to work? You know, but at the time,
how many years ago was that?
I think it was six. Yeah, six. So I had a lot of the artists starting to come out, and it was, you know, there, I think there was a culture in Australia at the time where if you bring an artist out, you know, and like you kind of do a show, and then if the show sells out, you do a second show when everybody makes more money and blah, blah, blah. And I said, like, you know, if you haven't banked on doing this second show, let's just ask the artist if they'd be able to give up a couple hours of their time for free.
Yep.
And I'll give up my time and my resources for free. And we'll run a show and we'll just give all the money to the charity, you know? And you know what, Pete, like straight off the bat, it was like the first one was like successful. We did Clapton was the first one we did. I'd gone up to the Fred Hollis Foundation and they were a bit iffy about like this dance music thing and blah, blah, blah. I walked in the next day with 20 grand and they were just looking at me going like, you know, and then it happened again and it happened again. And then like they called me and they were like, you know, you have no idea how long it takes people to raise this amount of money, you know. And like, and then on top of that, the whole music community in Melbourne started getting behind it as well. And, you know, people started coming up to me going, when are you doing the next fundraiser? And I was like, well, I don't know. But, and they were like, well, we're coming. And I was like, but you don't know who's playing yet. And they were like, we don't care, we're coming. And then the show started to carry a lot of weight themselves, you know. So like,
you charge $25.
We charge $25 entry. Yeah. Which, you know, every person walks in the door restores the eyesight of one person. Brilliant. So that's
it's quantitative. Like,
yeah, exactly. You know, absolutely. You know,
so you can actually see where money's going. If
yeah.
Spent, it's going
totally.
Back. That just
makes perfect sense, you know. So like, yeah. So I've had this relationship with the Fred Hollis Foundation for 6 or 7 years now. And it's just like, you know, like they just kind of trust me to let me do my own thing. And the thing is, Pete, it's not me. It's like, you know, I'm probably like the forefront of it and spearhead, but I like organize it. But like, you know, it's like my team, the Thick as Thieves team, do a lot of the work. They set up all the events, you know, like the artists give up their time, you know.
The artists want to do it. The artists.
Yeah, it's Pete, like it's amazing now. Like I, you know, it went from me having to write these emails to these artists going like, there's this foundation in Australia. And you know, sometimes like one of the things I learned from talking to the artists about it was a lot of artists get asked through a lot of charity shows, and a lot of charity shows, like the actual shows, like it's just, it's a crowd of people with good intentions, but they don't know how to run events.
Yeah.
So like the event means, you know, it's a bit half-hearted and there's not that many people there. And then the artists, like they've given up a night of their time when they could be earning income to, I guess, feed their families or whatever, which is, you know, it's a totally fair point. You know, if somebody asks them to do something on a night when they could be earning a wage. So, you know, a lot at this early on, there was a, you know, there was a bit of reluctance about it. But I think once we get into year three or year four of doing it, like the word had spread, you know, the artists like all loved giving up their time. They, you know, and, you know, when you get like a lot of the bigger artists that I've toured, you know, Patrick, Clapton, Kalsh, Anthem, Lovebirds, people I got there, you know, when those guys do it and everybody else sees it, everybody else will go, I want to do it as well, you know, like, and yeah. I mean, yeah, we've it's just become like a snowball now. And it's like, you know, we've a lot of the artists come through all the time are up for doing these charity shows. So, I mean, it's a win-win for everybody, you know, there's no, yeah.
What was the, like, raised, you said there, 20 grand in one night? Like, what's the most that you've ever raised?
I think one of Patrick's shows, Patrick Topping's last charity show, we did, like, I think it was like 33 grand in a night. Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing, man. Amazing. Yeah, yeah.
And what would the total be now? Because I know it's over $500,000.
It's about
unreal.
That was, yeah, I think we've done, I think it's about 620 or 630 grand.
Yeah,
a minute. Yeah, yeah. But again, Pete, like, I'm not going to sit here and, it's not just me. It's the Melbourne music community. It's the artists. It's the, you know, it's like my team around me. It's my partners. You know, I've JV, joint ventured with, like, you know, the hardware guys. You know, like just the Untitled guys, a lot of the Melbourne music crews, you know, we've all banded together and put shows on. Like, if you know, just to give an example, like I had Dennis Cruz playing at Babylon last year, and then me and Kyle worked together on a charity show, you know. So, yeah, it's just like every
it's a win-win-win.
It's a win-win-win, yeah, absolutely.
The end product is, you know, you're making a difference, you know, to people's lives. Ah,
totally, like, totally. And you know, like it's like, you know, I think, you know, one of the things which I don't want to preach about it, but one of the things people don't realize is, like, it's $25 to most Australians, not a lot of money. $25 can change someone's life. You know, it can absolutely, it's the difference between, you know, like, you know, having your eyesight and not having your eyesight. It's crazy when you think it's fucking, I've walked into a cafe in Brunswick Street last week, and it was $28 for a burger, and I was going, like, you know, this is somebody's eyesight we've got here, you know. It's like, yeah,
we, like, you know, it's we just take it for granted as well,
totally,
don't we? Like, mornings I wake up there, you know, your gratitude or whatever, you just, you know, you're grateful for your arms and legs and your eyesight, your smell,
absolutely,
your
yeah, yeah,
we just take everything so for granted. We wouldn't know ourselves if we didn't have our eyesight.
That's right, that's right, yeah. But it's an amazing foundation. It's something I'm very proud to be a part of, you know. And for my birthday a couple of years ago, when I'd got to the 250K mark, the foundation said to me, like, Mike, you know, look, you know, 10,000 people's eyesight would love to bring you to see what we're doing in one of the other countries. And I always had this thing where I was like, I'm not going to use the money that we're raising to fly me over there, whatever, you know. So for my birthday, for my 40th birthday, my one of my best friends, Jess, who works for us, like, Jess basically arrived at my door and was like, you're going. I bought you the airline tickets. You know, there you can travel with the doctors. So I spent a week in Cambodia traveling around with a Fred Hollows medical team. And, like, what I saw over there, Pete, was just, like, it only – like fueled the passion further, you know. There was one day in particular, I remember I went, so Cambodia is obviously, you know, they had a civil war not long ago, and you know, there's like one of the big issues over there is landmines. So you see people walking around everywhere with
amputated legs
and amputated arms. It's like, it's very sad, but at the same time, of all the countries I've been to, I think the Cambodian people were the happiest people I've ever met in my life. But we were traveling between Phnom Penh and Siem Reap, and we stopped in, and there was a building that had been bombed during the war. So it was like the Fred Hollows Foundation had set up this makeshift operating theater to kind of, was like a catchment area for the local tribes and villages.
Yeah.
And we walked in, it was like cooking hot. There was this doctor in there, and they kind of had like three beds lined up. So we walked into this, it was an old school, and the whole way down the corridor of the school, it was just lined with people on their hunkers. Like there was probably 200-300 people who had come in from the local areas to get their, you know, every single one of them had like one or two eyes damaged by cataract disease. And, you know, they're just sitting there waiting for this operation. And I'm looking, going like there's so many of them, you know, how's this guy? And it was one doctor. And, I went in, I probably spent 4 hours with him in the operating table, and that 4 hours just changed my life. It was like what I saw. So he was just the first operating table he was getting people up. So when one of the nurses would get people up there, and they would spray the stuff into their eyes, and it would harden, and it was like a antiseptic for the outside of their eye. And then move them over to the next table, and there was another nurse who, like, when the outside was hard, she'd just put a massive needle into their eyeball, and just like it makes people squirm, but it was like it would anesthetize their whole eye. And then the next table over from that was where the guy did the operating. And you know, he was just like, I mean, it sounds a bit gross, but this is what he was doing, man. He had them lying down, their eye was totally numb, so they couldn't feel a thing, but they were wide awake. He had like a blade in the scalpel, and he was just cutting their eyeball open, and he was using like a fish hook and pulling out this cataract, and you could put it on your hand and see it. You know, it was like a little like a fish eye. I mean, some of them were quite big. Some of them would be like literally like half the size of your small fingernail. You're like, this thing's living in these people's eyeball. Yeah. And he'd pull it out, and then he had this little inocular lens that he put inside, and he sealed up their eyes. And you know, if these people were blind, like they had a patch over their eye for 24 hours, and they woke up the next day, they took it off, and they had nearly perfect vision. And it was unbelievable. Like, now this wee guy, this doctor, like it was like probably 45 degrees in this room. He was doing between 8 and 12 of these operations an hour. And he was there from like 8 in the morning or 7 in the morning till 8 at night. He was doing like nearly 100 a day. Wow. And I was just looking at this going like, this is, my mind was blown, you know? And then on that trip as well, I got a real insight into what was, I guess, the scope of what they were doing in regard to, you think, so I guess you have the assumption that like you're helping the person who's getting their eyesight restored. But what you realize, like we went into some of the villages, so the people waiting on their eyes, like as soon as some of the elder people, their eyesight starts to deteriorate, they kind of get like shunned into the corner of the village, and there's no TVs or radios or anything. So then their children have to drop out of school to look after them. The children are feeling resentful. They're angry with the parents. And there's this whole mental health component that you didn't realize existed, you know, going on just because the kids are feeling resentful that they had to drop out of school to look after their parents. So I think one of the Fred Hollis team told me that like for every one person that they restore their eyesight, it actually affects 8 or 9 people around them, you know? Yeah. And it was, yeah, it's just
ripple effect.
Absolutely. So it was just, I mean, it was that trip, just, as I said, it just seeing that the impact that they had on these communities was just, it was incredible. And it was something that I was like, I was really glad I experienced. It was hard to look at it for a while, cause you realize how fucking good we've got it. Oh, you know, like you know, as I said, like we can just walk into any doctor surgery, and as soon as they detect the cataract, you're in the hospital the next day, and it's out the next day after that.
Yeah.
But you know, unfortunately, nobody, not all people have access to those facilities.
Yeah, I remember I was there in 2013, and
that's right. What were you there for again?
With a charity who believe children should be in schools and not brothels.
Right. So yeah.
Sex trafficking, and again, I was the same as you. It broke me open, like the things that I seen and witnessed, and it was just like I didn't even know this went on, and it was I totally relate to what you're saying. It just broke me, and I haven't been, you know, you come back a different person.
Totally
passion. Oh. You know, you're kind of, like everything goes through the roof. You want to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely, like, absolutely.
So I can totally feel your pain.
I think it's something like, I would say, like, you know, I mean, we've both done a lot of personal development, and you get to learn about like stuff like, you know, ego. But you know, when you travel in like a third world countries, that's a reality check. And you know, what you don't realize is like you live in Australia. If you're one of the if you're living in poverty in Australia, you're still living in the top 2% of the world population in regard to wealth.
Yeah.
So like, you know, everybody here's got access to mental health facilities. Everybody's got access to housing, you know, like everybody's got access to food of some description. But over there, it's just like, you know, people who have like, who are suffering from, I guess, you know, problems and issues. It's like there's no facilities until some of the NGOs come in, or, you know, like organizations like the Fred Hollis Foundation to help them, you know.
And still, they're the happiest people I've ever met in my life.
Pete, that's, isn't it mind blowing, mate? Isn't it like, you know, you see, Pete, I was like, you know, like, I remember one of the moments like I had where I was with this old guy who had like, he had an amputated arm and he had an amputated leg, and his leg was literally like a pirate's, you know, like stump. And he had both his eyes done, and like the doctor said to me the next, like I spoke to him for quite a while before he went in for his operation. He was quite funny, you know, like, you know, we had a translator and he was making jokes about like, he wasn't sure if he really wanted to see the wife after all these years, stuff like that there in case he got a shock. But I took the next day the doctor said to me, do you want to take the patch off his eyes? And I took the patches off his eyes and can't even begin to tell you what that was like. You know, it was just like seeing someone who's able to see again for the first time in, you know, such a long time was like, you could just feel the energy in the room, Pete. Yeah. You know, it was like, it's just a moment. Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, and just seeing the happiness. And I guess it was a real like moment of the Melbourne music community helped provide this, you know, like seeing the impact on, you know, thousands of miles away, you know, from people coming to Revolver to go to these shows, you know, like it was amazing.
It's a nice connection.
It's a great connection. Yeah,
it's a connection that probably people wouldn't link together, but it actually works.
Absolutely,
it's a treat because people do want to help. Like ultimately, I think people are good at their heart.
Absolutely,
know, at the core, but we just, you know, it's just we need ways to, you know, bring it to surface, sort of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that you would come back from that just pumped, like, you know,
totally. You know, so
emotions, but then that would drove you even more, right?
So I think it took 4 years to raise the first 250k, and then I said I wanted to raise the next 250 in 2 years, and in 3 years we did that, and then I said I wanted to raise the next 250 in 2 years, and we're well on track to do that. And you know, like, I mean, hopefully, like, you know, I mean, you know, a few people have said to me, like, you know, you're going to get to the $1 million mark. And it's like, yeah, we will. But like, you know, it's not going to stop there. So, like, you know, it's a milestone. It's not a target. You know, it's like it'll be a moment in time. And yeah, it'll be great to have reached that. Yeah. You know, I'm hoping we get there like maybe 2021.
Brilliant.
But, you know, at the same time, it's like it'll just be like another event. We celebrate it and then we move on, you know.
So you do other stuff here. So the Coastal Trek is something.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So tell me more about that. So that's walk, run.
It can be whatever you want it to be, you know. So I started like in, I think it was 2015. I kind of set myself a little bit of a personal challenge, which was to do an Ironman triathlon.
Yeah.
And I hadn't had the arsenal seat of a bike for 20 years before that. And, you know, like I just thought I'll try and raise a bit of money for Fred Hollis Foundation doing it. And then, you know, raise some money. And so many people after that messaged me and said to me, you know, I kind of wish I had known about this. I might have done it with you. And then I realized the Fred Hollis Foundation, they organize this thing called Coast Trek every year, which is it's like a trek. So it's like a walk or a run or whatever you want it to be. And there's two distances. There's a 30K and a 60K. So I just got three of my mates together and said, like, you know, let's do this. So we did it the first year. There was two teams the first year. And then I can't remember, was there two or one team? There's one team last year. We all did the 60K. But I thought this year, you know, it's our 10-year anniversary for Thick as Thieves. And, you know, we've had a great, connection with the Fred Hollis Foundation. So I rounded up, I got out early and, like, everybody who's ever in a drunken conversation has said to me, oh, I'm thinking about doing that. I just got the fish hook out and was just like, you're in, I've signed you up, you know? So I think there's 24 of us now, doing, like, you know, there's four of us doing the 60K and there's 20 doing the 30K. And some of these people doing the 30K is like, I mean, when I told some other people that I have them signed up to walk or run 30K, there was a, a few question marks to say the least on whether they could make it 3K, let alone 30. But it's been amazing. Like, there's you know, a lot of the guys are out now and they're doing 15, 20K runs at 6:30 on a Friday, Saturday morning. And, you know, that time they would have been scraping themselves down the stairs at Revolver, you know, like, but
seeing people who would never have thought, seeing checking in on Facebook that they're running and stuff.
Totally. But
it's like, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's been great because, like, everybody's been so enthusiastic about it. It's like, you know, and, you know, I guess people who are normally associated with the nightclub industry are like putting the bracket of being unhealthy and, like, yeah. You know, they're doing this 30K run now or walk or whatever it is, but, like, there's not many other people out doing that. So, yeah. Like, you know, it's a bit of an anomaly for the industry we're in, but it's like, it's just gathered so much steam, and the crew that are doing it are amazing. They've got, like, you know, there's a real sense of camaraderie, and there's a bit of big WhatsApp group, everybody's taking the piss out of each other, you know. So it's on 24th of May. It's on down the peninsula, and we'll put a donation link in the show notes after. But yeah, we're starting fundraising as of tomorrow morning, and we're hoping to raise over 40 grand between us, you know, which will be
fantastic.
Another milestone. Yeah.
Again, it's like, you know, these guys that are doing the run, it's like for their health, you know, it's a win-win-win.
Totally.
Like,
yeah, you know, totally.
It's just not about raising money. Like, they're getting healthy.
Absolutely.
Like, you would never have done this.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. Yeah, there's a few. I'll not name any names, but there's a few that.
Well, it's great to see.
It's like, fantastic. It's and I think as well, Pete, what it's doing is it's spreading the message about the Fred Hollows Foundation because, you know, they're all. One of the things the Fred Hollows Foundation have told me is that the amount of people that have liked their Facebook page in Melbourne between the 18 and 35 degree age group is significantly higher than the other states. And, you know, that might not be us, but there's a good chance we contributed to it. High correlation. There's a good chance we helped contribute to that. And with charities, people who tend to follow a charity from a young age, they tend to stick with it. So if we can get people interested in, you know, and active on the Fred Hollows page, and if we can get them, like, following the charity now, like, you know, if that lasts through their lifetime, then that's, you know, it's what raising the money is great, but raising the awareness of the foundation is just as important, you know.
So that longevity through.
That's it.
And if people want to know more about Fred, just Google Fred Hollows Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, all the Coast Trekkers, when you finish Coast Trek, they give you a little pack, you know, and the Fred Hollows autobiography is in it. And I would encourage anybody to read it. Like, it's just, you need motivation. I mean, what that guy did was just, like, you know, he just took on every establishment, you know, was everything he was told that you couldn't do.
Yeah.
He just fucking went out and did and found a way to do it. Like, he reversed a Jeep into the side of a hospital he was working in, and just, like, I think he literally, like, stole loads of equipment and just put it in a plane and sent it to Vietnam so he could use it. I mean, like,
just ruthless, just whatever it takes.
But whatever it takes, Pete. But, you know, but like, you know, at the end of the day, like, who's going to pull him up for helping people? Yeah. You know what I mean? It was just, he was a renegade, but he was just, I mean, he's just an incredible human being, you know?
Unreal, mate. That's kudos to you. Like, it's inspiring to watch, as I say. And I guess it's one of the reasons why you're an inspiration to me and the group that's around. So, Mike, that brings me to the 10th year anniversary. So
yeah,
that's coming up in June. You've got a couple of big parties that are kicking off.
We certainly do, yeah, yeah.
Great lineup. So tell me more. You've just released the info over the last few days.
Yeah. We're planning to do, like, without letting too much out of the bag, we're gonna do we've got 10 things that were planned for the 10 years, and we're gonna do we've released a couple of the events. So it's been great because, like, you know, our big key flagship event, we've got Patrick Topping and Patrice Bimel. The story with Thick and Thieves, Patrick's amazing because, like, I contacted Patrick, I think it was 2013. I heard a track on a Jamie Jones podcast, and I was just like, what the fuck is this track? And it's this track Patrick had done called Any Amounts. And I contacted Patrick via his SoundCloud page, and I said to him, mate, look, you know, I run this touring agency based in Australia. Said, I know you haven't really got a big following, but, you know, just, like, I really like this, and I kind of just feel that something's going to happen for you. Would you be interested in coming to Australia? And I said, I can probably tee up a few gigs. And I remember Patrick at the time was kind of like, I think he was thought I was one of those, like, Nigerian scammers who was, you know, going to ask for his bank account details or something, you know?
Yeah.
But Yeah, Patrick came out and did a tour, first show, Revolver. He actually told me it was his first ever international gigs coming to Australia for that tour before any of his other big records came out. And then, you know, Patrick's incredibly loyal and just, you know, we've just had great synergy in regard to like the touring. He knows that, like, you know, Patrick's profile has exploded on a worldwide basis, but as well as that, like in Australia as well, like through, you know, us all working together. Like, I think he told me, like, if you look at his social media, his top cities are like, I think it's London, Dublin, then Melbourne and Sydney, like worldwide. So he's just got this, great connection with Melbourne and Sydney and the other cities in Australia. And he just, he just kills it every time. And his profile is just going through the roof. So like, Patrick being the legend that he is, like I just said to him, I want you here for the 10th birthday. And he just said, yep. He didn't ask what date it was, didn't ask anything, just said, yep, consider it done. And Patrice Baumel as well is coming for that one as well. Like Patrice is like one of the most interesting people I've met. Like he's really spiritual, like, you know, amazing, super good human being, incredible producer. You know, we've had a great connection as well with Patrice. And he just like, yeah, I said to Patrice, do you want to come back out? And he said, of course I do. So that's the main big event. Then we've got a lot of our local guys on that event as well. And then the week before that, we've just announced a show at this awesome venue out in Port Melbourne that hasn't been used much, called the Timber Yard. And that's it's with Boogs, obviously, like, who's, you know, Boogs is God in Melbourne. You know, he's like, there's the inspiration that he has created.
The king,
man. He's like the inspiration he has had for other DJs. And, you know, like me and him like became best friends as soon as I got here, just through a mutual love of music. And, you know, it's been amazing to have him on the journey with me. And you go on the Revolver on a Sunday morning, you just see people looking at him going like, the fuck is he doing? You know, like he just, like, I remember somebody said to me one time and it summed it up perfectly. They said, like, when Boogs plays, like, the earth moves. Like, and it's just, you just feel something different coming through the floor when he's playing, you know. So Boogs is going to be doing a big 5-hour set, which is going to be retrospective of all the music played over the journey with Thick as Thieves. And then weirdly, I told the story on my Facebook page the other day, but so I've got like a second cousin of mine, Ruben, and a young kid, and we weren't really that close until I came out to Australia, and then I figured out he was making a lot of music, and he was making EDM back in the day under the name Ruben Keeney, but he was like super young and super passionate, and I was like, the EDM thing was quite big out here. So, like, I managed to get him out here and get a few gigs under his belt, and he had a tour, and we made a vow. We said, like, the next time you come out, you're going to have made it, and you're going to stand on your own two legs, you know, and the tour's going to stand on its own two legs. So every single year I'd go home, me and Ruben would go to our local Chinese restaurant and we'd have a curry, and then we'd go out and listen to all the new music he made. And I'd come back in and say to me, wee brother and sister, I'd be like, this year, Ruben, this year, he's 100%. You want to hear the music. It's amazing. And it became this running joke in the family where they were just like, oh, let me guess, Mike, this is the year, you know, there's the year. But you know, about, I think it was like maybe October last year.
Yeah, 2018 was his year.
Ruben sent me footage of Jamie Jones playing this track. And then I sent it to Brian and to Boogs, and Boogs was just like, mate, this is going to be big. You know, like he's like, and then I just sent it out to, you know, once the promo went out, I sent it out to a lot of the DJs, and it just caught like wildfire. And we just, like, all of a sudden it went to number one on Beatport, sat there for 5 weeks over the Christmas period, which is one of the busiest periods. And then he followed up with another big record called The Pipes. And like, it didn't go as high in Beatport, but it was massive in the States.
Yeah.
And he's just like, yeah, the kid's got the Midas touch at the minute. Everything he's putting out just going straight to the top of the charts. And it's like, you know, it's a great moment for, I think, for me and Ruben, because like we've become so close. And I like,
what's his journey?
Well, it's like to have him like for our 10th birthday, you know, for him to nail it at this time, and is just amazing, you know. So we're really looking forward to that one.
So his alias is Rebuke.
Rebuke, yeah. So the Rebuke comes from Ruben Keeney, you know. So like, yeah, he's
what age is he? How old is
he? He's 26 now. So I mean, he was out here when he was like 17, you know, like, so yeah.
I heard his hot mix on Pete Tong's show like maybe a month or two ago. Brilliant. The tracks are unreal.
Yeah, like, totally. And it's great, like, you know, I'm looking at him, I'm seeing him on all these lineups in Miami with like, you know, Patrick and Dennis Cruz and all a lot of the big guys, you know, like, so
yeah,
it's great.
Brilliant. So that brings us to the next thing, Mike, which you're just back from Vancouver.
Yeah.
In Canada. And I remember, like, you sent me this website maybe about 2 months ago and says, hey, check this out and see what you think. Like, Tony Robbins does this thing, you know, once a year.
Yep.
There's Dave Asprey, you know, from Bulletproof Coffee that does it. You know, all these gurus go to this place and do this 10-day retreat kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I was looking at it and I was going, yeah, of course, go.
Yeah.
Like, and you were toying with it. And then he says, yep, I'm doing it. You're going to go to Germany at one stage?
Yeah, that's right.
And then
you
decided to do it in Vancouver. So it's called Bio Cybernaut for those who don't know what we're talking about. But tell us more, Mike. Like, I know we've.
So, it was interesting because it was the DJ Anna who I tour. Anna's like super interesting person, you know. Her and her partner Weba, like I tour both of them, and they were out here. Anna mentioned to me the last time she was out here that she had done this thing, and probably the first time she mentioned it, I kind of glossed over it. But me and her were driving to a festival this year, and we started having a bit of more of an in-depth talk, and I was telling her that I'd like, you know, I'd been you know, meditating on and off for 4 or 5 years, and kind of like everybody, you know, meditation's hard, you know, when you struggle with it. But Anna meditates for 2.5 hours every day. Wow. Like, and I just found this fascinating, and she's so zen and so centered. And then, you know, we got on this, she told me about this Bio Cybernaut thing, and she sent me a link to it. And the more I delved into it, the more I guess I like it, just caught my attention. And the whole thing with it is, I guess how it works is you're when you meditate, you go into an alpha state. And when you're in that alpha state, your brain is more creative, more productive, more efficient, you know, all the good stuff. So for example, if you were to like read a book when you're in alpha state, you'll retain a lot more of the information than you will say, for example, if you're stressed. Yeah. And the whole idea with this place is to help you create more alpha brainwaves. So it's something that you can't really do unless you're getting live feedback from your brain. So you go to this center, and for 7 or 8 days, you're in there every day, and they connect these electrodes in the morning so you've got the chambers in your brain are called your frontals at the front, your centrals in the top, your occipitals at the back, and your temporals at the side. And you go into this chamber, and every day, every time your brain, each one different part of your brain sends an electrical signal, the electrode picks it up and it sends it through a computer, and it then the computer will generate a noise. That noise is different for every different chamber in your brain, but it's like orchestral sounds. So like you might have like a harp here, oboe here, flute.
You're like a one-man band.
You're not far wrong. So you're going into this chamber every day, and you're sitting, and as your brain's firing off these signals, you can hear all these noises. And the whole idea is to try and get your brain to generate more alpha waves. And the first thing they do is they teach you how to suppress it. So it's a very I guess crazy experience, because what you're sitting there and you're basically thinking like negative bad stuff, and the music just drops. You can't hear any sounds, and you know then that you're able to suppress it.
Right.
And then when you start doing like, I guess, positive stuff, you can hear the sounds getting louder and louder. And there's sometimes when this like thing is so loud, it's like it's really surreal. It's totally surreal, but you can tell your brain's raising loads of alpha waves. So you're in there and you're doing, you know, they've got a exercise program that they do for you to help increase the amount of alpha waves.
So it's basically brain training.
It's brain training, yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's a big, I guess, what you call an emotional and a therapeutic component to it as well. So you go down every day at the end of the day while you're in this chamber. They do this thing called these mood scales, and it's like you get like just hundreds of these words, you know, adjectives like happy, anger, jealousy, whatever, you know, flashing up on the screen, and you have to rate on a 1 to 5 how you're feeling about that, and or give it a yes or a no. And the electrodes are pretty much like a lie detector, because when you come back up, they have a big chart and a graph that say, right, well, you know, you said you weren't feeling jealous, but all the your brain did this while you said that.
Yeah.
So then you talk through it with a therapist, and you know, you're talking through the issues you've got in life, and over the course of the week, I tell you what, Pete, there was no stone unturned. There's like everything from, you know, father's death, relationships, you know, anger problems you've had with people, you know, the whole, everything comes out. And the idea is that, like, you discuss it with a therapist and then you go back down the next day while you're in the chamber and you do this forgiveness work. Well, the whole idea is, like, you want to release as much of this negative emotion as you can, because then your brain will automatically generate more alpha waves, which will... So, you know, I didn't realize there was stuff I'd been holding on to for years that, like, you know, it was... But, yeah, through the work I did over there, I came back and I felt incredibly focused. And I've struggled with sleep issues for quite a few years. Yeah. Not total insomnia, but, like... not getting enough sleep and not getting enough REM sleep and, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and being awake for a couple of hours. And since I've come back, it's like my sleeping pattern's been a lot better. I feel focused at work, you know. I think of Steve's guys will probably still tell you I still can't read down below the third letter line of an email and reply to stuff when I'm supposed to. But, yeah, no, I feel more centered, you know.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed, like, as I said, if we went for dinner that time, I've noticed, like, you're just more – present,
yeah,
like, you know. And that's not to say that you weren't, but you just, there's something different about you,
in a good way, yeah,
right? So whenever you hear the likes of Tony Robbins go to this, those sort of top
guys who,
there, like, must be something in it, like, yeah, it's not fad.
The likes of me and you who do a lot of, you know, I love doing personal development. Some people, like, criticize it or whatever, like, each to their own, you know. But it's like, it's you know, you're constantly trying to be the best version of yourself. And, you know, there's people that, like, when you dig a bit deeper, there's people that, you know, you kind of aspire to the way they live, you know. And it's like, you know, when you see a lot of the people who are, like, you know, people like Tony Robbins, like, you know, what people don't realize about him is, like, he's actually, like, a genius in, like, so many different fields. He's an expert therapist. He's, like, a master of finance. He's, like, he was, you know, when Bill Clinton got impeached for the Monica Lewinsky thing, the first person he phoned was Tony Robbins for help. He was like Serena Williams and Michael Jordan, sports coach Mike Tyson.
Yeah,
you know, like, people like that don't respect this guy if he's not the real thing. Yeah. You know, he's a huge philanthropist. He's got a charity in the US that's raised they fed, I think it was
the homeless.
Yeah, I think it fed since it's begun, they fed 250 million people, which is amazing. So, you know, he's just one of many. Dave Asprey, who's, like, probably the world's leading biohacker, he was going back year after year. And what do you call the guy from Mind Valley? Vision.
The Indian dude.
Vision something, like, yeah. You know, like, and you know, I mean, when we were there, there were so many pictures of people who, you know, recognizable stars or whatever, like, but, you know, yeah,
that's social proof. It gives it credit.
Absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
Guys, you know.
And they were going back again and again. Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's not like they're doing it once to try it out. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was amazing. It was really, really cool.
And do you think you'll go back to that again?
100%. I'll definitely go back. You know, it's, like, there's other stuff that I want to do as well. Like, I think I'm really keen to do a Vipassana.
Yeah. So, because it sounds like, so, you know, with what you're saying about the, you know, releasing the stored emotion, you know, and the therapy that was intertwined to it all, it seems like an intense week of therapy that's actually measured, you know, with
absolutely, absolutely.
You're going, this is, you know, getting rid of this, you're getting rid of this. Like, people, a lot of people don't understand, and, like, I've been through this too, that, like, you know, whenever something bad happens or traumatic, you know, we push it down and we suppress it and we, you know, don't try and forget about what we're doing. Is that's the worst thing you could do.
Absolutely.
Like, we take on, like, I remember being on antidepressants to just to try and forget these
thoughts. But then that makes you numb. It just doesn't get the root of it, you know.
Process it. But like, the way, you know, like the old saying, you got to feel it to heal it.
That's right. That's right.
It's the scariest, most horrible thing, but it works.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know,
it sounds like that's what you sort of
absolutely
had to go through and remember all those things or whatever. And the passion, I think, is the same, but I just don't think you're getting measured.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, I mean, this thing, like, there was one element there was something that kept coming up for me, and it was through with an anger issue I had with someone. And, you know, I went down the first night, and they came back up and said, no, it's still there. They went down the second night, no, it's still there. Now the third night, it's still there. And, like, you know, I had to really... really dig deep and work on it. And it's probably something that I didn't want to let go of as well. But, you know, it's like,
your ego kicks in.
That's right.
Just going, oh, fuck
this. Yeah, exactly. No, but it was an amazing experience. And thank you, Anna, if you're listening out there, because
two and a half hours she meditates.
Amazing,
for, like,
man.
Deepak Chopra is like around 2.5 hours. Yeah. And the Dalai Lama's 4 hours a day.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny with Anna, because it's like she's just like, you know, like really cute, like kind of yogi zen chick who plays a slamming techno, you know, like just like the antithesis of what you would imagine. But yeah, she's a great human being. And so was like Weba, her partner. He went and he had a really good chat with him when he was out as well about Vipassana as well. And
is he into it as well?
He's into it. He made a very good comment to me, we had a good discussion where he was like, he came out of it and he was just like, oh, I don't really feel that different and blah, blah, blah. And he said like 3 months later, it just came to him and he just went bang. It was like, I get it. You know, now he just felt a big shift, you know, and it was like, it was really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely the passage is on my cards too. I was booked in at one stage, but then bailed because it's a 10-day silent retreat.
Yeah.
You can't look at people who are in.
Totally. You can't exercise. You can't, you know, yeah. I think one of my best mates, Brian, he had done it. He's actually gone away to do 21 days now.
Right.
No, he's actually doing it in the UK. He's originally Scottish, and me and him were really good mates over there, and he's living in Australia now. But he was in a bit of a mess with his life, and he just went into Vipassana, just completely sorted him out, you know. And he goes back now like probably once a year, twice a year, and does it, and just keeps him on the right track.
Unreal. So we've covered a lot of stuff there, Mike. I've learned a lot, like I didn't know, which is exactly what I want. I'm sure everyone watching enjoyed that too. But is there anything, like, I know people can now go to Fred Hollow, is there anything else that you'd want to talk about?
No, I mean, not really, Pete. I mean, it's just like, this is my first time ever doing something like this, so it's all new to me. But I hope everybody was able to understand me. But
I'll get the captions up once it goes up.
But just for anybody out there, like, you know, we're going to be doing a big push tomorrow with raising money for a Coast Trek. And just anybody who's not like the Fred Hollows page, can you please just go ahead and do it? It'll take 2 seconds and just follow like the incredible work that they're doing, you know?
Yep. And then go to follow the Thickest Thieves page too. That's where all the Coastal Trek
that's right.
Links will be as well.
Yep.
So cool. Well, mate, thanks.
No worries, mate. Great to be on. And hopefully.
We'll go get some food now.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, all right, Pete.
Thanks.